Okay, all right. We are going to carry on. So we are now on to welcome. I'll try that again. Welcome to ITE1, Module 12. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about installing, configuring, and optimizing operating systems. Somebody could tell me, I'm sure you can all tell me, some of the different types of operating systems that you can get on the market today. I want one from everyone, thanks.
Linux.
Thank you, Elise.
I was waiting for all the
Somebody?
Windows people to start up.
Yeah, come on, guys. Some other operating systems.
You know, it takes ages for
XP
Windows to start up.
Home?
XP,
Oh,
yeah,
they're on
on Windows.
XP Home.
Yeah.
I was going to
All the
say, good
various
one, XP
permutations
Home.
thereof. Well, yeah, sorry, I'll take that back.
It's definitely one, but we've got any intercontinental microphones working here? Anybody over there in the other continents with their microphones working today? Any operating system examples? Examples of operating systems? Yeah, Solaris or Slowaris, yep.
Yeah, good one.
How about
Nobel.
HPUX?
Yep.
OS2, I haven't seen that one for a while.
Yeah.
What about Berserkly systems? I mean, BSD, FreeBSD, NetBSD. Yeah, we've already had Sun Slowaris. Yep.
Mac OS.
OS
Yes,
X.
thank you.
OS X, thank you, yep.
Okay,
yeah, that
yes,
went
so
bankrupt.
Windows Server.
Yeah,
yeah,
Windows
we've got a
Server.
Whole
Yeah, things like
thing,
Longhorn
yep.
and stuff.
Yep.
Hey, Amiga OS.
Or Millennium
Oh,
Edition
yeah, can't
7.4,
forget the
more commonly
Amiga.
known as Vista.
Okay, let's see how many versions of Windows we can come up with.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 3.1, Windows for Workgroups 3.1. 3.1, wasn't it, Kerry? 95. 95 build A, build B, build C. Windows 98. First and second edition, Windows ME. Windows 2000. Windows XP, Windows 2003 Server, Windows Vista, and now the Windows 2000 Server and 8, and have I missed any?
Yes, you missed
XP
Windows.
Yes.
was home and professional, and Windows Server 2003 comes in four different flavors, if I remember, plus Windows 2000 came in three or four flavors as well. The server
and,
edition, sorry.
And the next bit in the notes are going to say you have to choose which operating system suits your client.
Yes.
They certainly are.
And
yes.
If you're an easily confused computer user, then why not log on to Microsoft.com, where you'll get a bewildering array of tables, choices, and confusing information that will help you empty your wallet faster into the coffers of Microsoft. And that's just the versions of Vista. Also, keep in mind with OSR 2 for Windows 95. But as you can see,
yes,
Windows
I said
and
Bill F- C and Bill B. Yep.
How about Windows CE?
Yeah, that's a good one.
So yeah,
Gemma
lots of
just
different.
Just said reminded us of Windows NT as well. There's also the Windows Mobile, which is based on the CE platform.
Yeah, so there's a lot of flavors. Yeah, it's a bit like going to like Baskin Robbins or whatever your funky ice creamery is called. There's 50 flavors, and you really have to decide which one you want and which one's going to meet your needs. I would be personally suggesting at this point in time that Windows XP Home, if you can get it. Still, is still a good choice for a home user, but if you want to do like massive file sharing and stuff, then certainly XP Professional or XP Media Center Edition, which I don't think got mentioned, which is built on the XP Pro code base.
I think we have to have a cyber lollipop for just about everyone there. You've got just about every operating system we could think of.
Should we also go into the 32-bit and 64-bit editions of Windows?
You can do that if you wish.
The M edition, which they use in Europe because they're not allowed to bundle Internet Explorer with it or something like that.
Yeah, then there's an antitrust case.
Media player.
And then the six flavours of Vista.
There's six.
Something like that. And then there's always the all the different licensing like OEM, retail, upgrade editions.
Yeah, and the funny thing with Microsoft is they give things obfuscated names, like XP Home Starter Edition is the one where your computer will come up with a boot screen but not do much else. And then you've sort of got Home, and then you've got Home Ultimate, and then like Home Mega Amazing Wonderful, and then, you know, Business, Business Ultimate, Business. You know, one of the biggest problems that Office Microsoft has experienced, and a lot of software companies have experienced, is actually naming these things sensibly so that they actually make sense to the user. For example, there are about 5 or 7 different builds of Office 2003. And then you've got student, teacher, and home, and all this sort of thing. So figuring out what the product does is actually half the battle of choosing it.
It's marketing for you.
It's great fun. I used to work in retail, and we'd have to memorise all the differences between all the different Windows and Office versions, all the different pricing and the licensing and all that, because you'd always have customers asking what the difference is between all of them. You'd have to explain it.
Mm. And then they just go and buy the one you told them to buy anyway.
The other thing is looking at all your hardware requirements, and since we're going to be talking about Windows XP primarily here, I'm going to let Kerry do a quick rattle through those while I scroll down.
Well, the hardware requirements for what, sorry?
XP.
Oh, the hardware requirements for XP. Let me think. It's
16 gig.
Yeah, it's 64 mega RAM, I think, and 2.5 gig of hard disk space, and 550 megahertz processor. The processor must have a floating point unit, I know that. Well, it depends. And Super VGA monitor. Yes, it does require, and it requires a mouse. And a CD drive. Yes, it was the first Windows operating system to require a mouse and a CD and an optical drive.
Which one are we talking about? XP or Vista?
XP. Yeah, no, XP. Yeah, okay.
Anybody ever tried loading Windows 95 on off floppies?
No. 95 on floppies, yes, we did.
You get to about disk 21 and it goes, you go, oh no.
Right.
And it goes, unable to read this disk, and then you go and borrow the CD off your mate.
That's exactly right.
Yes, that'd be typical, wouldn't it?
I think they're the basic. But do check your notes for those hardware requirements, because they do frustratingly have them in the test. We just look them up off the box when we need them, but they are in the test.
Yep.
And be aware there are minimum requirements and recommended requirements.
That's a very good point, actually.
Yeah, minimum requirement, a scummy computer, recommended, a really cool computer. But, yeah, you do have to watch the minimum and recommended. In fact, a lot of games, and a lot of people are into buying games, have the minimum and recommended. And the minimum's where the blokes sort of shake up and down on the screen as if they're sort of, you know, driving along a bumpy road. And then the recommended requirements where it's like watching a movie, TM.
So beware of that in the test too, because sometimes you'll get it worded one way and sometimes another, so just be really careful to read and reread your questions. Kerry, was that your signal to go, was it?
No, we're staying a bit later. We don't actually need to leave quite yet, so I'll be with you wonderful people until about 12:30, and then I'll start packing up.
Okay, no worries. Okay, so now we're going to talk about network operating systems, okay, which are going to obviously give you additional functionality, and also, you know, obviously you're going to need them in your network environment. How about some examples of different network operating systems? Go!
Linux.
Yep.
Mac OS.
Windows MT. Yeah, CentOS Server, yeah, that's part of Linux. Windows NT, Windows 2003 Server, Windows 2008 Server, half a dozen Windows versions.
BFD.
Excellent, doing well. Okay.
Lantastic, no, just kidding. Novell is a network operating system.
I was going to ask you that, Kerry, yeah, because I haven't seen it around for a while, but I needed to know that for some other thing I wanted to do.
Novell Open Enterprise Server is actually based on Linux.
It's based on Linux.
So you actually call that an operating system?
Well, yeah, it never used to be. It used to sort of kickstart itself up off DOS, so it was a network operating system that ran based on DOS. But if my memory serves me, the new versions of Novell actually, as if they're based on Linux, actually bring up a Linux kernel and stuff, so they are self-contained, so they're a bit like VMware ESX Server, which is a full operating system environment.
Okay, so as the name implies, they are going to allow you network server is going to allow you to have network resources to everybody who's on the network. Things like sharing of your databases, a centralized repository for data storage, things like network printers, so you're sharing resources. Also, accessing and security issues are going to be handled by the network server. And also redundant storage systems, things like RAID and backups. That'll be the phone.
That's just a reminder alarm. Spot question, and this is not in the notes. Can anybody tell me why you don't use XP Professional as your file server operating system in a big company? Apart from Chris, who probably knows the answer, so you're not allowed to answer.
Aww.
Is it because the licensing arrangements only allow you 10 connections or 10 users?
That's right. And the other thing is that it's locking and stuff on things like access databases and stuff, which people insist on using.
No, horrendous. Good at all. Yes, I know. You lock up a file and you never get it back.
Unless you use Unlocker, which you shouldn't because it's quite dangerous. Oh.
Well, it's my opinion.
Now, just for people who don't know, Unlocker is a little utility that you can get for Windows, that if it says this file is in use by an application, you can go Unlocker and the file name, and it will actually destroy any file system locks on it so that you can get at the file no matter what. Sometimes that is necessary, and it is quite useful to be able to do that, but I would caution you that you'd better know what you're doing before you do that.
Yes, we have to put the legal disclaimer with that, don't we, Kerry? Use it at your own risk.
That's right, and when it breaks, you do keep both pieces.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Kerry. Okay, so the network operating system's got several protocols that it has to help it do its functions, and they are actually controlled by the server. There's a code on the network server, The protocols used by the network operating systems give you services like file transfer and email, name resolution, and also things like automatic IP addressing. One of the network protocols, the Hypertext Transport Protocol, that allows or defines how your files are exchanged on the web. And that's an important one to remember, HTTP. Okay. Hypertext Transport Protocol.
HTTP.
Okay. Most of your operating systems are fairly easy to install. Most of us have probably had a go at installing an operating system. Would that be correct?
Actually, in last year's lecture, and I meant to mention this, we actually have a Linux install up on the KAVI website that you can listen to.
We do.
We actually run through a Linux install.
Is it in what, module 10 or something, or is it sort of on its own somewhere?
It's under extras, I think, isn't it?
I'm not sure. It's called Linux install. It isn't actually numbered, so it's one of the files that isn't numbered.
I've got a feeling it was in extras or something like that, but yeah.
Well, I'll probably move it into the ITE folder anyway, but we'll get the location of that and post it to the mailing list so that people know where it is, because it's certainly worth a look at. We've also got a recording where Gemma and I do an installation of Linux, which we'll also put up at some point, because it's actually a lot easier to hear. It's recorded in our lounge room, so you don't get quite as much echo and lab noise as the one that's already up there. So you'll have two different ones to listen to. We promise we won't put up the podcasts about us cooking steak or changing tap washers.
They might like that.
Not relevant to the course, I'm afraid.
You can get a Cisco certification in tap washers.
Now, you especially need to cook this router well on both sides.
Especially if you use the water analogy for bandwidth exercises.
Exactly.
Okay, so when we're installing XP, we can just talk a little bit about the different types of installations. And we're specifically talking XP today.
And how do blind people install XP? Just before we go on with what the notes actually say.
Get Gemma to attend.
You can get Gemma to do it, although there's only a couple of us here who have that luxury. Some of you who are more remote students may not be able to get Gemma to install it for you. Or get Chris to do it. Yeah, that's right. Unattended installs. Yep, that was the answer I wanted. And there's an article on Blind Cool Tech, www.blindcooltech.com. In fact, there are thousands of articles on all different sorts of things, but one of them does go through unattended installs of Windows-based operating systems. And you'll be able to actually practice that with a virtual machine at some point. I've actually done an unattended install into a virtual machine, so that'll be fun for next semester.
Yay!
Yeah, next semester we get lots of fun things happening. Get to crash virtual machines, which is really good. Okay.
Yeah, there was one day when they actually tried to change the IP address of the interface that they were telneted in on. For those of you who don't know...
Go on, Kerry.
I was saying, for those of you who don't know, changing the IP address of the interface that you've just telneted in on will usually stop your telnet session from working quite successfully.
Break it.
Okay, so we have our default installation. It's the one where we go... I'm waiting for a bite here, but anyway. Next.
Do you see my worksheet on that? I just said, oh, yeah, yes. I do all the custom stuff as I go through because I don't want to go back in and do it later.
I was waiting for Kerry.
Oh, no, I'm absolutely. I was just going to say, don't be a next.
Set it up top
the rabbit.
That's why I purposely said that. Next.
You thought you'd catch a fish and it didn't bite.
No.
I think the other thing you've got to keep in mind about hitting next, and I've seen a lot of JAWS users do this, is they forget to read what's actually in the dialog box. And I want to write a utility once that goes, once you click the next button, this will format your C drive. Click next to continue. See how many people get caught out by it, because they all just hit next and go, oh, that's not important, Yes.
I've seen people do that.
If you hit next now, your computer will self-destruct.
It's vitally important that you pay attention to what you're doing when you install the program, because if you mess it up and it all goes pear-shaped, you're going to need to be able to tell the poor, long-suffering technician what you did.
Mm. Okay, the other type...
tell the technician they didn't do anything wrong.
Well, that's right. It's the computer's fault.
It broke itself.
That's right. Okay, so the next type of installation is your custom installation, which we're just sort of talking about a little bit. You get a chance to customise things as it sounds. So you, in the first screen that you'll get coming up, is customises the regional settings, and the second one is to customise your network settings. It is a good way to make it sort of suitable for what you particularly want, what type of performance you want, what preferences you want.
Ah, now that's just a little gotcha here, and this will bite you badly. In fact, it's got big teeth on it, and if you come past it, it will just go chomp. If you install a typical install of Windows and you do not customize the regional settings on your computer, the default is US English. Can anybody tell me what is the default paper size for the US?
Letter.
And if you've got an A4 laser and you're dumping letter documents to it, they will automatically be crunched, munched and resized and be sent to it, or you'll get the lovely meta use, the lovely thing, load letter. And if you actually fix your regional settings and tell it where you actually live and make sure the paper size is actually A4 and all those sorts of things, a lot of those problems will go away. And in fact, this problem can be quite nasty, because if your Word templates are designed for A4 and you try and pull them into a Word that defaults to letter, bad things TM happen.
Another thing to watch out for when you're going through those dialogues is to also set your regional settings for the time and date purposes too, or you'll go sending out emails with the wrong time on them.
Yeah, I've seen that before too. And make sure your computer clock is correct, because none of us here should be sending out mails dated the 1st of 1980.
Oh, whatever the east coast of America happens to be behind Australia.
Okay.
Yes,
it can break too.
Yep, in fact, the browser will complain bitterly that the security certificate is not yet valid or has stopped being valid, because some SSL certificates, which we don't talk about too much at the moment, do have a validity time from and to. So that's something definitely to be aware of. Sometimes the certificates on the site are broken too, though, so that can also happen, as well as your computer's clock being wrong.
And we touched on the unattended installation just a moment ago. It's come up in my notes now. It's using the unattend.txt answer file. And the answer file can be created using an application called the Setup Manager, or Setup MGR, I should say, .exe, which is located on the deploy.cab file on your XP CD. So you would then answer all the questions that it says, and then the unattend.txt files then gets copied to the distribution shared folder that's on the server. And then you can either run the unattended.bat file on the client machine, and that'll prepare the hard drive and install the operating system from the server over the network. Or you can create a boot disk, and that boots up the computer and connects to the distribution on the server. And then you run the batch file to install the operating system over the network.
Now, if you're really serious about this, have a look at unattended.sourceforge.net, because it does all of the unattended things that Microsoft doesn't, and it's sort of a Linux-based distribution with a copy of Perl. And if you're really serious at rolling out a lot of these, you'll actually get the unattended system up and running, and it will let you install 30 or 50 workstations in a matter of minutes. Unattended.sourceforge.net, it's not part of the notes. I don't want to be posting irrelevant stuff to the list. unattended.sourceforge.net. Otherwise, Google up Linux unattended Windows install and you will find it. But I can't encourage you to go and use Linux, because if it breaks, you do keep both pieces and I take no responsibility.
Okay, the second type of installation that we can talk about is an image-based installation. You'd actually begin that by bringing or configuring one of your computers, making sure it's operational. Then you would run the sysprep, S-Y-S-P-R-E-P, and that prepares your system to take the image. You can use a third-party drive imaging application, which would prepare an image of the completed computer, and that can be then burned onto a CD or a DVD. You can then, after that, copy that onto the computers and complete your installation on one or more of those computers. Once you've copied the image, you can then boot up the computer. Be mindful, though, that you might have to configure some of your settings, things like your computer name, that type of thing. All right, another one was your remote installation. It's similar to your image-based installation, but you wouldn't be using a drive imaging utility. But you can remotely set up Microsoft Windows by using a network shared folder as the source of the Windows operating system files. You'd then install the operating systems on a remote boot-enabled client computer, and then the user computers would be connected to the network, and then the pre-boot execution environment capable network adapter or remote boot disk is used, and you then log on as the client using whatever the particular user account is you need. It's sort of a good way to do it if you've got a fairly small network, and not a good way if you've got a low speed link or a wide area network. The Microsoft System Management Server, or SMS, would allow an administrator to manage large numbers of computers on any network, and SMS can be used to manage updates or give you remote control or inventory management, that type of thing. And one of the optional things it has or features is the operating system deployment, and that requires the installation of SMS OS deployment feature, which is a pack on the Windows 2003 service. And it also allows the installation of large number of client computers across a network, such as a local area or a wide area network. Okay, the some of the things, I'm just scrolling down here. Alright, we're talking about disk structure. The disk management utility gives you information and services, things like partitioning and formatting of disks. We've probably all done a little bit of formatting in our time, I'd say, but several types of partitions on a hard drive. Yeah, whether we've meant to or not. Anyone done that?
No, I've been quite lucky.
No?
No.
Well, that's good. Okay, there are a number of different types of partitions on hard drives. Yes, exactly. You have the primary partition, there are extended partitions, and there are logical drive. Extended partition? Sorry, yeah. The point to bear in mind there is that at any particular time you can only designate one partition as the active partition, and the operating system then uses the active partition to boot up the system, and the active partition needs to be a primary partition. In most cases you'll find that C:\ drive is the active partition, and we probably all note that on our own computers, and that contains the boot and the system files.
I'd just like to point out that this is absolutely 100% true for Windows. It is, however, not true for Linux. You can actually mark all of the partitions active if you so want to, but if you are sharing your hard disk with Windows, you must follow these guidelines, which is why they're given.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's easy, just rip the hard drive out.
You can create additional partitions, though, if you want to organise your files or to be able to dual boot your computer. Getting to the disk management utility, anyone done that, like to go through that?
Right click my computer, press G for manage.
Not Kerry!
Actually, you can actually go start run.
No, it's
start run. Yeah, you can go that way. You can go start run diskmgmt.msc is the other quick way to get in.
Oh, thank you, Kerry. That's handy.
Oh, I'm just having a dig at him there.
Anyone else? Anyone else want to tell us how you get into disk management, the boring site and click the mouse way?
What's the administrative tools under control panel, wasn't it?
Yeah, it can be if your control panel shows administrative tools, yes. Most people right-click there, my computer icon, click manage, go down to the bottom of the tree, and there it is in disk management. That's how most people get in. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now when we're talking about partitioning partitions, they're formatted using a particular file system. In Windows XP, there are two. Can anyone tell me what they are?
FAT and NTFS.
More information about the first one.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Well, the old FAT32, FAT32,
file
table, yep. There is a big difference between FAT and FAT32. In fact, there's a big difference between FAT16 and FAT32. For example, the maximum size of a FAT16 partition is going to be 2 gigabytes, and that information is in the diagram descriptions.
Anyone want to tell me what FAT stands for?
File allocation table.
Thank you, Elise.
What's the maximum size of a FAT32, Kerry?
4 TB, I think, theoretically.
Okay.
4 terabytes, basically.
Oh, yes, it is 2, yep.
Anyone want to tell me what NTFS stands for?
New Technology File System.
Thank you, Leah. Excellent.
Or Neanderthal technology if you haven't installed the latest service pack.
Okay. All right, so NTFS has got more stability and security features. What was that? Our file system.
Yep, that's correct.
That's correct. Okay, excellent. All right, I'm just scrolling down.
Geraldine is scrolling down.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in the notes that's sort of like...
Waffle.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just getting past the waffle.
I have a feeling some of this is also covered in Chapter 5 of the worksheets.
Some of it certainly is, actually. Mm. That's a good point. But it is very important to read through each chapter's modules.
Oh, absolutely.
Not because we want you to. Not because we want you to, but we do. But because it'll make you get a better mark in the test, and that will make you happier.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just pointing out for interest's sake. I'm not saying don't read Chapter 5 or Chapter 12. Read them both.
Exactly. Especially if you can't sleep at night. It'll definitely send you off. Okay. System tools. when you're optimizing an operating system, there is a number of various tools that you have in Windows. Things like disk error checking, which will look for errors, as it sounds, and file structure errors, and there's also the hard drive defragmentation, and that can help you to consolidate files for faster access. Now, defragmentation, anybody who doesn't do that to their computer? Well, they're not going to admit it.
There are some people who erroneously claim that defragging on NTFS is not required. And I'm vehemently like
Hello?
To...
Yes, go.
Yeah, who said what? Did you...
That was a question, I think.
Did somebody have a question or something they wanted to say about defragmenting or whatever? I was just saying you need to defrag on an NTFS... volume, otherwise things will start going very slowly and you'll start burning coasters and things. Well, no, it doesn't clean up the free space. It reorganizes the files and it consolidates the free space, but it still leaves all of the data in the free space. It doesn't actually erase it, which is how forensic people can get data back off your computer even when you don't want them to. You should defrag your machine depending on your usage patterns. If you're doing a lot of CD and DVD mastering, or you're downloading a lot of privately produced media content for your enjoyment off the internet, for example, the home movies of your neighbour or something, you would want to be defragmenting perhaps once a week, once every 2 weeks, or once a month. And you will find that doing a defrag on your system drive can greatly enhance performance if you're using hard disks. If you're using solid-state disks, it's not as critical.
And I think, you know, if you probably the average user once a month, if you schedule it in first of the month or something, that way you're not going to forget to do it. It's probably a good idea.
My parents-in-law actually have the Saturday computer ritual where they update all the virus definitions, update the spyware definitions, defrag the hard drives, run CCleaner, and that's part of Saturday morning's take care of your computer ritual. It's just as important as brushing the dog.
They've got a good maintenance regime.
Absolutely. Okay, the virtual memory of your computer allows your CPU to access more memory, and it's done so that each of your applications can address the same amount of memory. So virtual memory has a swap or page file, and it's constantly being read in and read out of the RAM. So you'd normally let Windows